Will the members please show their attendance by voting? Has any member failed to vote? Will the clerk please take the roll?
Thirty-one present, nine absent.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Speaker, excused from the call of the House today are Representatives McKinnon, Randolph, and Buchholz. At this time, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that Representative Buchholz be excused from the call of the House March 7th.
There's no objection. Representative Buchholz is excused on March 7th. The prayer today is by Pastor John Tyndall of the Northern Lights United Church. Will the members please rise for the prayer?
Deep within each of us, O Lord, there is the throbbing life of the universe. Love. Enable us to express most fundamentally who we are by being spirited in the midst of contention, fair-minded in the midst of disagreement, positive attitude in the midst of defeat. We pray in the name of the one who came to say that the final word to each of us is your love. Amen.
Will the record please show that Representative Meekins and Representative Guy are present? Will the Chief Clerk please certify as to the correctness of the previous day's journal?
As Chief Clerk, I certify as to the correctness of the journal for the 50th day.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the journal for the 50th day be approved as certified by the Chief Clerk.
There's no objection. The journal for the 50th day is approved.
Mr. Speaker, may we be at ease, please?
House, please stand at ease. Introduction of guests. Are there any guests to introduce to the House today? Representative Montgomery.
Mr. Speaker and Golly B, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Les Wells, who is Executive Director of the Alaska School Activity Association.
Representative Guy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Again, this morning, it is indeed a pleasure to be introducing some young constituents from my district in Gallery B. Please withhold your applause until I've called off their names. Ignatius P. Matthias from Nightmute, Ephraim White, Lower Kalskak, Eddie Philip Akechuk, Nick Chuglock, Napaskak, Margaret Chase, Nunapichuk, Max Angilan, Quihluk.
Representative Jara.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the press section today, I would like to introduce a young constituent of mine there. She is attending the University of Alaska and down here on assignment, Fran Rines.
Representative Freeman and I have a group of students and their chaperones here from Ketchikan. It's from the White Cliff School of sixth graders, and members will hold applause till I've introduced the entire group. In Gallery A, Carla Tallman, Kelly Jodry, Wendy Miles, Rhonda Palmer, Carol Busby, Janine Lowell, Tabitha Gregory, Julie Whiteman, Shelley Klaus, Tina Hendrickson, Carolyn Walters, Julie Montgomery, Gina Siebel, and the chaperones Kay Pearson, Paul Jarvey, and also Eric Michelson and Trevin Walker. Are there any further, Representative Miles?
Mr. Speaker, can the record reflect my presence in the chamber, please?
Will record please show that Representative Miles and Brown are present? Are there any further guests for introduction to the House today? Messages from the Governor?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Messages from the Senate?
The Senate has passed the following and it is transmitted for consideration. Senate Bill number 56 by the Rules Committee by request of the Legislative Council for the Code Revision Commission, an act relating to the effect of homicide under the Uniform Probate Code.
Judiciary.
I have no further messages from the Senate, Mr. Speaker.
Communications.
No, Mr. Speaker.
Reports of standing committees.
The Committee on Judiciary has had House Joint Resolution 22, requesting the federal grand jury to hear charges and complaints against the Secretary of the Interior and other Interior Department officials under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it do pass with attached amendment. The report was signed by Mr. Parr, Chairman, concurred in by Phillips, Martin, Barnes, O'Connell, Anderson, and Parr. House Joint Resolution number 22 has no further referral. The Committee on Judiciary has had House Bill 75, relating to privacy and public information and changing Rule 65 of the Civil Rules of Court under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 75 and recommends that it do pass and attaches a letter of intent. The report was signed by Mr. Parr, Chairman, concurred in by Parr, Phillips, Barnes, Anderson, Martin, Malone, Brown, and O'Connell. House Bill 75 has no further referral. The Committee on Finance has had House Bill 136, a special appropriation to the Department of Fish and Game for purchase of a sonar fish counter at Nooshagak under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 136, Finance, and recommends that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Meekins, Chairman, concurred in by Meekins, Duncan, Moss, Rogers, McKinnon, Freeman, Montgomery, Haugen, and Schaefer. House Bill 136 has no further referral. The Committee on Community and Regional Affairs has had House Bill 174, relating to the participation of elected officials and former elected officials in the public employees retirement system under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 174 and recommends that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Parker, Chairman, concurred in by Parker, Kearney, Parr, Jaroff, O'Connell, and Metcalf. Branson signed do pass as amended. House Bill 174 has a further referral to the State Affairs Committee. The Committee on Hess has had House Bill 255, Sale of Food from Self-Service Bins, under consideration. A majority of the committee reports it back with an attached amendment and also with individual recommendations. The report was signed by Mrs. Munson, Vice Chairman, signing do pass, Miles and Munson. Signing do not pass, Chatterton, Byrne, and Barnes. Signing no recommendation, Hurlburt. House Bill 255 has no further referral. The Committee on Finance has had House Bill 296, Transfers Between Appropriation Items in the Fiscal Year 79 Appropriations for the Department of Administration, Pioneers Homes, under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 296 and recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Meekins, Chairman, concurred in by Meekins, Duncan, McKinnon, Rogers, Moss, Schaefer, Haugen, Montgomery, and Freeman. House Bill 296 has no further referral. I have no further standing committee reports, Mr. Speaker.
Reports of special committees.
No, Mr. Speaker.
Introduction of citations and resolutions.
Citation honoring Congressman Austin Murphy by Representatives Bettisworth and Hurlburt. I have no resolutions for introduction, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Anderson.
May we be at ease, please?
House, please stand. We're under introduction, first reading, and reference of bills. The House, please stand at ease again. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to make a request of members at this time. Apparently, there's been somewhat of a problem when people have asked that bills be held over after they've been introduced. A lot of times, as soon as a clerk has finished reading the bill, they are sent downstairs for printing. And if a member makes a request after that process, a lot of times the clerk or their staff has to run back down and pull the bill back out and thus causing a delay in printing. So if you would please, I'd like to ask members of the House to right after the last bill has been read into the record, that you go ahead and make your request to hold over your bill at that time, rather than waiting until we get to unfinished business or down to further down the calendar. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Would Chief Clerk please read the first introduction of House bills?
Sponsor substitute for House Bill number 240 by Duncan, Cotton, Hurlburt, McKinnon, Miles, Miller, Munson, Parker, and Gardner. An act creating the Alaska General Stock Ownership Corporation and providing for an effective date.
State Affairs and Finance.
House Bill 341 by the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. An act relating to the requirements for runoff elections and municipal elections.
Community and Regional Affairs and Judiciary.
House Bill 342 by the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. An act relating to approval and recording of subdivisions and providing for an effective date.
Community of Regional Affairs and Judiciary.
House Bill 343 by Branson. An act relating to the management of general grant land by municipalities and providing for an effective date.
Community and Regional Affairs and Resources.
House Bill 344 by Branson. An act making a special appropriation to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs for grants to municipalities and other recipients in place of entitlements under the program of state aid to local governments and providing for an effective date.
Community and Regional Affairs and Finance.
House Bill 345 by Jaroff. An act making a special appropriation to the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities for paving of the Otmaloy Point Road in Kodiak and providing for an effective date.
State Affairs and Finance.
House Bill 346 by Jaroff. An act relating to fishing area markers.
Resources.
House Bill 347 by Hayes. An act relating to workers' compensation.
Labor and Management and Judiciary.
House Bill 348 by Hurlburt. An act making special appropriations to the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities for road equipment to be located in Alakanuk, Eminuk, Hooper Bay, Red Devil, and Shagaluk, and providing for an effective date.
State Affairs and Finance.
House Bill 349 by Haugen. An act establishing an Alaska Transportation Project Priorities Board.
Commerce and Finance.
I have no further bills for introduction, Mr. Speaker.
Brings us to consideration of the daily calendar. Will the Chief Clerk please read the first item on the calendar?
House Bill number 26 by Duncan and Miller. An act relating to insurance coverage for persons receiving benefits under the Public Employees and Teachers Retirement System. The Committee on State Affairs has had House Bill 26 under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 26 and recommends that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Miller, Chairman, concurred in by Miller, Martin, Metcalf, Gardner, Parker, and Fuller. The Committee on Finance has had House Bill 26 under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it be replaced with a State Affairs Committee substitute for House Bill 26 and recommends that it do pass and attaches a fiscal note. The report was signed by Mr. Meekins, Chairman, concurred in by Meekins, Duncan, McKinnon, Rogers, Schaefer, Montgomery, and Freeman, signing no recommendation, Smith and Moss. I have one committee substitute on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that State Affairs Committee substitute for House Bill number 26 be accepted in lieu of the original bill.
If there is no objection, the State Affairs Committee substitute will be accepted in lieu of the original bill, House Bill number 26. Are there any amendments?
I have no amendments on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the State Affairs Committee substitute for House Bill number 26 be considered engrossed, advance to third reading, and place in final passage.
There's no objection. Committee substitute for House Bill number 26 is engrossed, advance to third reading, and place in final passage. Will the Chief Clerk please read committee substitute for House Bill number 26 in final passage?
Committee substitute for House Bill number 26 by the State Affairs Committee. An act relating to insurance coverage for persons receiving benefits under the Public Employees and Teachers Retirement Systems.
Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The purpose of this bill is very simple, I think, but also very important. It would provide that present and future retirees, those age 65 or over, could receive auditory, visual, and dental insurance coverage. Under the present system, this benefit is not extended to those people who have retired and would apply both to the PERS system, the state retirement system, and the teacher's retirement system. A very important provision of the legislation is that the cost of this insurance is picked up by the person receiving the benefits. On line 16, it says a person electing to have insurance under this paragraph shall pay the cost of the insurance. So this provides that those retirees can receive these very important benefits if they so elect, if they so choose to go back and pick up the cost of the insurance. Of course, these benefits are available to them by being in this package, which other teachers or which present teachers and present public employees participate in. This insurance is available to them at a much lower cost. One other just very brief explanation on your desk is a fiscal note for that's the wrong fiscal note. It's a fiscal note for $20,000. I might point out that as the bill left Finance Committee, we recommended a zero fiscal note. And I would like to make that point for the record that the bill would be passed with a zero fiscal note. We don't believe that the extra person is needed to administer the program. Therefore, it's my recommendation, or Finance Committee's recommendation, that there not be a fiscal note attached to the legislation.
Representative Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, through Mr. Duncan, what was the Legislative Board of Retirement Benefits recommendation on this bill? I noticed we have a letter here dated February 22nd, and it's been 2-3 weeks since that period of time, and I'd be interested in their recommendation.
Representative Duncan.
I don't have the recommendation on it, but I'd be very surprised. Well, maybe I wouldn't be surprised knowing what they've done in the past, but I don't see how they could recommend against it, since it's not costing anyone anything except the retirees. It's an individual's decision whether or not they want to participate. If they participate, they pick up the cost. It's not costing the state one thin dime, and especially since we've passed out a zero fiscal note. So I'm not aware of their recommendation.
Representative Meekins.
Excuse me, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Duncan is correct in that. Of course, the purpose of the of sending information to the retirement committee or whatever they're called is to protect the state from incurring large amounts of expenditures because of unknown effects on retirement bills. And this one very clearly, and I compliment the sponsors and the people who worked on these changes. It's a very innovative approach. It doesn't cost the state anything, and it helps out the people under the system quite a bit. It's a very excellent method, and I think I'm really happy to support it wholeheartedly, because from a $1 million fiscal note, we're down to zero fiscal note, and yet at the same time there will be accruing very substantial benefits to the people who do pay for it. I think they get it at a very less expensive rate than they would if they had to do it privately. So it's really a very good approach, and I hope that we can do as good in other retirement bills in the future. So I'd ask the body to support this.
Is there any further debate? The question for the House is final passage of committee substitute for House Bill number 26. The members may proceed to vote. Clerk may lock the roll. Do any members wish to change their votes? The clerk may take the roll.
Yeas, no nays, 3 excused.
Committee substitute for House Bill number 26 has passed the House. Will the Chief Clerk please read the next item on the calendar? Representative Parr.
May I have a brief at ease, please?
House, please. Will the Chief Clerk please read the next item on the calendar?
House Bill number 66 by Chatterton, Malone, and Phillips. An act providing an exemption for senior citizens from payment for land leased from the state. The Committee on Hess has had House Bill 66 under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it do pass with attached amendment. The report was signed by Mrs. Buchholz, Chairman, concurred in by Barnes, Chatterton, Miles, Byrne, Munson, and Buchholz. The Committee on Finance is at House Bill 66 under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 66 and recommends it do pass and attaches a fiscal note. The report was signed by Mr. Meekins, Chairman, concurred in by Meekins, Freeman, Montgomery, Haugen, Guy, Schaefer, Moss, Rogers, and Duncan. I have one committee substitute on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that Finance Committee substitute for House Bill number 66 be accepted in lieu of the original bill.
There's no objection. The Finance Committee substitute for House Bill number 66 will be accepted in lieu of the original bill. Does Chief Clerk have any amendments on the desk?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that Finance Committee substitute for House Bill number 66 be considered engrossed, advance to third reading, and placed on final passage.
There's no objection. Committee substitute for House Bill number 66 is engrossed, advanced third reading, and placed in final passage. Will the Chief Clerk please read Committee Substitute for House Bill number 66 in third reading and final passage?
Committee Substitute for House Bill number 66 by the Finance Committee. An act providing an exemption for senior citizens from payment for land leased from the state.
Representative Chatterton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is a run again at a bill that passed this body in the 10th legislature by an affirmative vote of 38 to nothing too excused, but due to the press of other business in the one of the committees at the other end of the hall, why, it got no further, so the three of us reintroduced it. Now, a brief explanation of what the bill does, I'll try and make, Mr. Speaker. First of all, why, to justify its existence of the bill, AS Statute 2953020 paren E provides for exemption from property tax for residents in the state over 65 years of age. In other words, if a person owns real property and he's over 65, upon proper application, why, his property taxes are forgiven. Also, Mr. Speaker, Section 2973060 provides residents over 65 in the state for a property tax equivalency payment up to a maximum of $375 per year if the person does not own any real property upon which he's making his home, but is actually renting. Well, Mr. Speaker, that seemed to us that that left out one person that might be making his home on lands leased from the state. And the purpose of this House Bill 66 is to forgive the annual rental for a person making his home, his place of abode, upon lands leased from the state of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Miller.
Speaker, could I, through the chair, address a question to Mr. Chatterton? Number one, and I should know this from all the leasing legislation we've had, but I can't recall. Do the people who hold these leaseholds pay local borough or city taxes, similar to the taxes that a homeowner, for instance, pays?
Representative
Chatterton. My understanding is that there, and I only learned this, and I'm not sure, there might be another person in the body that can answer this much better than I, Mr. Speaker, but I think it depends upon the borough and or the municipality. But I have heard that there is a borough that does assess a person who is living on lands leased from the state some type of a property tax equivalency also, in addition to the annual lease rental. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To confirm Representative Chatterton's remarks, generally the leasehold interest is taxable. In this case here, of course, we're talking about residents who are 65 years of age or over and are eligible for the state residential property tax exemption that such citizens may enjoy upon application to the local government. But the leasehold interest is owned by a private person or company is generally taxable to the extent of the leasehold interest.
Representative Metcalf.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. One thought that comes to my mind with this bill, there are some leases that are 80-acre leases that do have a resident living on that lease property, and it might create a problem, or not, depending on your point of view, that those people are intent on subdividing at some point in the future that 80-acre parcel and are living on a small portion of it. And I wonder if that issue has been addressed, and I'd like to hear some comment.
Representative Miles.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think if the former speaker looked at lines 18 and 19, he'd see that that specific question has been addressed in the Finance Committee substitute. It says no exemption may be granted for any portion of the lease which is used by the leaseholder for any purpose other than his permanent place of abode. So the exemption would apply to the actual place of abode, but not necessarily the rest of the 80 acres.
Is there any further debate? Question before the House is final passage of committee substitute for House Bill number 66. Members may proceed to vote. The clerk may lock the roll. Do any members wish to change their votes? The clerk may take the final roll.
Thirty-six yeas, no nays, four excused.
Committee substitute for House Bill number 66 has passed the House. Representative Duncan.
Mr. Speaker, if I might, just relative to House Bill 26, Committee Substitute for House Bill 26, so there's no actual confusion, I'd like to make a motion. That would be I'd move that House Bill 26 be passed with no fiscal note, zero fiscal note. I'd like that to be shown in the record.
If there's no objection to the motion, it will be reflected in the journal that the fiscal note for House Bill number 26 is zero. We had one member who was here didn't register their vote on the last bill, so we'll have to take a roll call, and the previous roll call will be voided. Under the rules of the House, if a member is in the chamber, he has to vote. And so we'll take another roll call. Question before the House is again the final passage of committee substitute for House Bill number 66. Members may proceed to vote. The clerk may lock the roll. Do any members wish to change their votes? The clerk may take the roll.
Thirty-seven yeas, no nays, three excused.
Committee substitute for House Bill number 66 has passed the House. Will the Chief Clerk please read the next item on the calendar?
House Resolution number 1 by Freeman and Haugen, relating to land allocation in the Tungus National Forest. The Committee on Resources has had House Resolution 1 under consideration. A majority of the committee recommends it do pass. Report was signed by Mr. Miles, co-chairman, concurred in by Osterbach, co-chairman, Chatterton, Cotton, Carney, Fuller, and Jaroff. Signing no recommendation, Miles. I have no amendments on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Freeman.
Mr. Speaker, this simple House resolution, it's 4.5 pages long. I'll try to be very brief about it. I don't see any reason why members should have problems with it. Under the Forest and Rangeland Renewable Resources Planning Act, the Secretary of Agriculture is required to make recommendations on the rare system, which is roadless area review and evaluation.
Okay.
This happens to be number two. They've done the first one, and this is the second one. Under the law that's on the books, they are supposed to come up within the National Forest with a land management plan, and this is supposed to be brought about by working together the Forest Service and the citizens of the different areas and different occupations, so forth, of the community. And the particular area that I'm interested in here, of course, would be the Tongass National Forest. And we have in process a Tongass Land Management Plan, and that has not been completed. The time has not run out. It's not a time problem on their part. But the Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, Rupert Cutler, has announced that he's going to make those recommendations. And Mr. Speaker, when you start, notwithstanding the fact that he hasn't looked at the land management plan yet, and when you start talking about roadless areas in the national forest, you are saying no logging. That's what it boils down to. And all this resolution asks is that they withhold the decision on the rare two until such time that the recommendations and the input from the local people have had a chance to be put forth. And that's simply what it amounts to, and I would ask that you support the resolution.
Is there any further debate on House Resolution Number 1? Question before the House is the final passage of House Resolution Number 1. Members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? Clerk may lock the roll. Do any members wish to change their votes? Clerk may take the final roll.
Yeas, no nays, 3 excused.
House Resolution Number 1 has passed the House. Brings us to the end of the daily calendar and to unfinished business. Are there any items of unfinished business to come before the House? Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent that Representative Byrne be excused from the call of the House from 11 o'clock a.m. on March 8 through March 9.
Could the House stand at ease? Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to withdraw my motion to excuse Representative Byrne. Make the same motion tomorrow, however, giving Representative Byrne an opportunity to firm up more nearly his schedule. Thank you.
I might announce to the members that we're tentatively planning a Saturday session, and even if the House does not have a Saturday session, most committees will be meeting. We're under unfinished business. Are there any other items of unfinished business come before the House? Special orders. Representative Meekins. Representative Meekins.
Last year and in years past, historically, what's happened in state spending is that we have, of course, we have some state revenues that the agency spend, and we have some federal money that's given to us by the federal government. A lot of times when we leave here, we don't know how much federal money is going to come, and we appropriate what's anticipated. What's happened in the past is that the agencies, while awaiting the federal money, have spent incurred debts against the state treasury, hoping that the anticipated federal money would arrive and that they could then bail themselves out in that manner. And what's happened a lot of times in previous years is that the federal money did not arrive, and so they couldn't bail out what they spent for the state, and we've had to come in with supplementals. So last year, the legislature, on page 2 of the Free Conference Report, put in language which would prohibit that activity. And it stated very clearly that no money could be spent, no federal money, until you got the actual award of the federal money, you couldn't spend any money. In other words, you couldn't spend state money while you're waiting for the federal money to come in and reimburse you. And I think, of course, that's a very appropriate thing to do. It's only good sense that you shouldn't spend money that you don't have or that you aren't sure you're going to get. But what happened there was that the governor disagreed with that, and he vetoed that language on page 2 of the Free Conference Committee. And because he vetoed that language, several agencies, and one primarily Health and Social Services, continued in the same manner. In fact, there's information from our legislative auditor that shows us that the agency actually had a good chance, or is a high probability, that they knew they weren't going to get the federal money and yet continued to spend state money on the theory that the federal money would come in, of course knowing that what actually would have to happen is that they'd incur the debts and we'd have to pay for them, because when debts are incurred, of course we have to come up with the money to pay for it. So that has resulted in a bill that was introduced yesterday, House Bill 339, request by the governor for a supplemental appropriation of $1.1 million. And all because the governor did not agree that this kind of good management practice ought to be put into the way the state works. And he vetoed that language, allowed the practice to continue, and indeed at least one agency has continued that practice, and now we're faced in a very austere year when we're cutting out a lot of good programs and a lot of things that the people here need for their own districts. We're going to have to spend $1.1 million to pay these debts that have been incurred because federal money that was anticipated actually did not materialize. It's a very poor practice, and I think that particularly in this kind of year, before when we've had surpluses, it hasn't hurt so badly. But this year, when we don't have enough money, it hurts very badly for these kind of mistakes. And I think that we really can't afford the governor making this kind of short-sighted, bungling, and improper and incompetent management of the state's resources. And I just thought I'd let the body know of the mistakes that he's made and what it's going to cost us.
If there's no objection, forgot to deal with Representative Hayes' motion. If there's no objection, Representative Hayes' motion will be withdrawn. We're supposed to have a State of the Judiciary message at 11 o'clock, so it'll be necessary to recess, and then we'll pick up after the joint session with the remaining orders of business. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that we stand in recess to the call of the chair.
There's no objection. The House is recessed until the call of the chair will be about 5 minutes. Under the joint rules of the Alaska Legislature, the President of the Senate presides at a joint session. Turn the gavel over to President Tillian at this time.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Will the joint session of House and Senate please come to order? Senator Coletta.
Mr. President, I move that the House consent to all calls for the Senate be waived and all senators be shown as present.
Without objection, the roll call is waived. Representative Anderson.
Mr. President, I move that the roll call of the House be waived and all House members be shown as present.
Without objection, the roll call is waived for the House. I'd like at this time to appoint a committee to escort the Chief Justice in. Representative Anderson and Senator Coletta, would you please go escort Chief Justice Rabinowitz to the chambers? That's right. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court and the Associate Justices with him. Would you introduce them, Jim?
Thank you, Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and the House of Representatives of the State of Alaska. In response to the President's request, this time I'd like to begin by introducing my colleagues who are here today. I'll start from my immediate right, Justice Roger Connor, former Chief Justice Robert Boutchever, Justice Warren Matthews, and Senior Justice John H. Diamond. Justice Burke is involved in personal litigation himself in the Anchorage area and was unable to attend today. Well, this marks the ninth occasion on which a Chief Justice Supreme Court of Alaska has had the privilege of addressing you in joint session. Now, the office of this privilege is to briefly advise you of our major legislative program, and we do sincerely appreciate the opportunity to take a small portion of your legislative session to have this opportunity to explain to you what we think is of significance to the Alaskan court system in terms of our legislative program. We are fully cognizant that there are inherent tensions in this tripartite form of government, and this is an occasion that we think lends understanding and content to the system of checks and balances and to the government, what we're striving for in Alaska. But at this point, I think, before going into the specifics, I think it's not inappropriate to give public recognition to the outgoing Chief Justice Robert Boutchever. As you all know, under recent constitutional amendments, the office of Chief Justice is rotated every 3 years, that is, we elect a Chief Justice from amongst the justices on the court. In large measure, due to his system during Chief Justice Bucci's tenure of 3 years met the fantastic population growth and the complexity of litigation and volume of litigation that the Alaska court system was subjected to. On the whole, and this is by way of introductory remarks, I think the Alaska court system, by way of general report, and you all get a detailed report that is our annual report within 3 weeks from the administrative office. I think on the whole, through the dedication of our administrative court, the support personnel, the magistrates, district judges, superior court judges, and my colleagues, the Alaska court system is meeting the challenge of a growing caseload and a more complex caseload. And I assure you that you have our commitment that for future years, with the limited resources we have, we're only talking about less than 3% of the total state budget. The Alaska court system, within these constraints, will continue to fulfill its obligations. And what are its obligations? Well, surprisingly, we are now experiencing a caseload volume of 130,000 cases annually. It's been noted before that for every 4 Alaskans, there's a case filed annually in the Alaska court system. We appear to be a most litigious population. Not only that, at the appellate level, we are 3 times greater than the national average. Old cases don't die easily. They come right up to us, they want to fight it out. And this burgeoning caseload is what we want to talk to you about today. One of the key points in our legislative program is a bill presently pending before the Senate that calls for the creation of an intermediate court of appeals. Now, this is probably the most significant change that we have asked for in 20 years since the creation since we obtained statehood from the legislature, the most significant change for appellate structure. Why are we asking for this? Well, Chief Justice Bucci, in his last address to you, said that we would come back this year with a concrete proposal as to how we were going to meet this rapidly expanding caseload at the appellate level. Justice Diamond was here at the very beginnings in 1960 at the Supreme Court. I had the privilege of coming on in 1965. And ladies and gentlemen, I can assure you that the incremental increase in terms of our workload are in the hundreds of percents. In the old days, in 1965, when I first got on the court, I authored something like 18 full opinions. We had a 3-justice court at that time, for those of you who remember. Last year, I authored 47 full opinions, and this was the average for my other 4 colleagues, and then Senior Justice Diamond authored probably another 20. Besides the full opinions that we are authoring, we have to review petitions for review, motions, rulemaking, and I just can assure you from a personal vantage point, this is not a frivolous request. We are now at the level, the same level, where New Mexico, Arizona, and the states of Washington obtain relief in the form of intermediate appellate courts. What are the positive advantages that we see in the creation of an intermediate appellate court? Well, one is, I think it must be all obvious to you from the likes of the Byrne Initiative and from the recent election contest case that this court, in Hatch-Mack Bay, this court faces some really tough questions. And you don't want a court that just backhands them and doesn't give it the full, weighty analysis and consideration it needs. If we're truly going to be an appellate tribunal and decide cases neutrally, study them analytically and with the care that they deserve, we cannot, and I have grave fears, but we can continue to turn out the quality work product that we have and have no relief. I think we really are at a saturation point. As I alluded to, New Mexico, Arizona, and Washington believe that they were and obtain relief from their legislatures. What will this do? Well, Representative Dankworth and the others know that in the criminal side of the courts, delay defeats everything. If you don't impose sanctions rapidly, it defeats police morale if cases drag on for years. It just is an element that should be eliminated. We perceive the passage of the intermediate court bill as a relief measure which will speed up the criminal process. And how will it do it? Well, this three-judge court of appeals will have final jurisdiction in most appeals from the district court, which now come to the superior court, and then could come on up to us under the old system. We'll also hear all sentence appeals from the superior court, and we'll hear all criminal appeals. Does this take this court out of, this court being the Supreme Court, out of the criminal business? Absolutely not. We do not become a civil tribunal by virtue of the creation of an intermediate criminal court of appeals. We have discretionary jurisdiction, just like this, under the bill, just like the Supreme Court of the United States has certiorari jurisdiction. We have the discretion to pick and choose those cases, criminal cases, that involve fundamental constitutional issues, involve procedural issues or substantive issues that have wider ramifications than a particular case. It will free us to devote the time that the cases should get, both on the criminal and civil side, and continue to maintain our own work product. What will it do for the superior courts? It will free the superior courts of the necessity of handling cases from the district court. Those are your misdemeanor appeals. Then we think that it will also speed up the resolution of civil appeals. So it's within this context of speeding up the process and of maintaining the quality of this court that I urge you to consider the merits of our intermediate court legislation. Now, for those of you who are worried about the constitutionality, I'm not speaking for my colleagues, I personally researched it. You read the debates of the Founding Fathers, you see it's very clear that they contemplated and they were of the opinion that the legislature had the power to create any type of intermediate appellate court they thought advisable. Does this fulfill the constitutional right, if there is one, of a defendant to an appeal? Well, it does in that, although there's no constitutional right spelled out, the criminal defendant will have his, in most instances, his full just appeal to the intermediate appellate court, and then with discretionary appeal to us. In other words, we do not lose, by virtue of this legislation, our status as a final appellate tribunal under the Constitution of Alaska, because we can call up any case which has the facets that I alluded to, the constitutional issues, the procedural or substantive issues of great importance. Well, that is our major legislation at the appellate level. Quickly at the trial level, and I said there are 130,000 cases filed for the small state. Of these, 1,000, and these get the most publicity, are criminal felony cases. It was about 1,060 last year, and the disposition rate was very favorable. 134 were disposed of. Well, we are not asking for significant legislation here, except in two respects. One, as far as rural Alaska is concerned, we want to have your approval of the creation of a Superior Court judge for the Kotzebue area. The workload there is really expanding, and this will have minimal financial impact, because we plan, if you act favorably on this, to abolish the district court position that is in Nome. In this way, you perceive of two Superior Court judges in northwestern Alaska, which will give the residents of that area, we think, improved judicial services for a total cost of only about $7,000 difference. Because this is reflective of our ongoing policy that in one judge locations, the judge should be able to hear all kinds of cases. A Superior Court judge has a jurisdiction to hear misdemeanor cases, small felony cases, felony cases, big civil cases. So we think it will result in an improvement of judicial services to rural Alaska and the urban centers in northwestern Alaska. Additionally, we are asking for one Superior Court judge in Anchorage. And why are we doing this? Since we last had an additional judge in Anchorage, Superior Court Judge Adam, the caseload has grown approximately 25%. Now, with the constitutional mandates which require a speedy trial, and our rule which requires a speedy trial on the criminal side, civil cases are languishing. Now, I have to admit to you that we are going to investigate internally our own investigation of the civil calendaring practices in the Anchorage area. We are convinced that the addition of one Superior Court judge will enable us to process at the trial court level civil litigation more rapidly. Then I want to apprise you of two developments. One will be coming back next year, but we think it's very significant. And that is in our extraordinarily able Administrative Director, Arthur Snowden, is presently discussing with the Governor's Office the possibility of the removal of conflict cases from the court system. Now, by conflict cases, I'm talking about criminal cases where the public defender has an ethical bar from defending both cases in a criminal, both defendants, one or more defendants in a criminal trial. In these cases, it is necessary that a private counsel from the private bar be appointed. Now, not only does the court system have to pay these bills, but the judges have to examine the bill, have to question each item, and we are convinced that it will result, if a conflicts office is created within the governor's office, will result in savings of at least $400,000 a year if government attorneys man the conflict office rather than case by case farming out, parceling out to members of the private bar. And another development which we might come back to you for this year in the legislature is in relation to the Anchorage Courthouse. I know this is nuts and bolts, and we're not talking about red China, we're not talking about Middle East crude, but this is the substance that makes the systems go. You got 130,000 cases filed in Alaska annually, and our business is to service the citizens of this state. And glamorous or not, I have to talk to you about Anchorage space problems. Our court facilities house the Attorney General's office, house the public defender's office, portions of both. The space is just inadequate. And Mr. Stout is negotiating with the federal authorities for a reasonable rental of the existing old federal courthouse. Some of you know that in Anchorage. Beautiful facilities, eminently suitable for court system acquisition. And we would certainly ask for your support if our negotiations are successful in funding the leasing of this space. Next, I'd like to talk about a subject which is unpopular. Judges are an unpopular subject matter these days, but if all of us, if all human beings were angels, we would be unemployed. To state the obvious, and you know that. Salary Commission's recommendations are 8% for this year and cost of living for the next fiscal. I think, and it's the last course position, these recommendations are eminently reasonable. I don't think I have to remind you that no judge in the state of Alaska has received a salary increase since 1975. Now, assuming that the Salary Commission's recommendations are rejected, and assuming further that the Salary Commission is not abolished, that means that at January 1st, 1981, when we were eligible for a pay raise, each judge, justice, will have suffered an erosion of 42% of his salary since 1975. That assumes an inflation rate of 7-8% a year. Well, to put it in real dollars to those of you, that means that a justice will be making $32,000 in 1981, by January 1st. Now, The risk inherent in this type of approach to the judiciary is no increases is One, I think it's vital that we not only recruit, but that we retain men who are intellectually equipped to solve a very complex litigation that comes with form, to have the moral fiber, who are not feckless or flaccid in the carrying out of their duties. And you can only do this if you go to the pool that's available. And what's the pool that's available? You have to look to the limited pool of successful, skilled attorneys in Alaska. And I don't think it will come as any surprise to you that most attorneys who fit that category make more than the existing judges do at any level of the Alaska court system. I think it is within this context that you ought to judge our request for salary increase. Now, the last subject I'd like to discuss in this address is one that's rather difficult to talk about. For the last 3 years, the Judicial Council has had understudy the effects of the Attorney General's abolition of charge bargaining and plea bargaining in three areas: Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. And last summer, I believe it was, while Chief Justice Pucci was still in office, he asked me to go up and sit in for him at a Governor's Commission meeting in on the Fairbanks campus. And there was a preliminary report at that time to be delivered by the Judicial Council on its study. Well, lo and behold, I walked into it. The study, without any advance notice, showed that there's some figures, 200%, 300% in the column, and I'm not a statistician, I didn't understand it. And it comes out that, according to the Judicial Council study, that Native Alaskans and blacks receive lengthier sentences in certain categories of crime, and that Native Alaskans are less likely to receive probation than their counterparts, their Caucasian counterparts, same offense, same, all things being the same background. This is really surprising information in a way. And what has the court system done since this report? Well, first I'm going to tell you about the court system's reaction, then I'm going to tell you some personal reactions that conclude this address. One, the court system has taken the position, despite any rumors you've heard to the contrary, we are positive, we are taking as a given the existence of racial bias. Whether intentional or unintentional, every discretionary stage of the criminal justice system, as far as the courts are involved. Now, given this fundamental premise, we asked months ago, we decided we would ask the Judicial Council to expand their study. The original study was only limited to felony sentencing and only limited to 2 years, 74 and 75. We've asked them to expand their study to include all felony sentences and key misdemeanor sentences in areas in rural Alaska, like Dillingham, Bethel, communities like that. So we're going to have a picture, an accurate annual picture of what goes on in the court system. We really never had this current system statewide, current information of the sentencing pattern. Now, what value would this be? Well, one, the mere fact that judges know that they are racially biased, know that they're being monitored annually, should have a salutary impact. Secondly, this information is going to be given to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. What's the Sentencing Guidelines Commission? You people last session already made the value judgment that the judge's discretion, racial bias aside, should be narrowed. You opted for a just deserts presumptive sentencing system, which narrows judicial discretion in sentencing. You wanted to have articulated criteria, which are going to tell the judges this is the range, according to the man's background, the circumstances of defense, which he should get in terms of sentencing. Well, we're going to give this information annually to the Sentencing Guidelines Committee. The Sentencing Guidelines Committee is composed of lawyers, judges, and the Supreme Court agreed that it is crucial that minorities have strong representation on the Sentencing Guidelines Committee. To this effect, we implemented. We appointed delegates from the NAACP, the Anchorage Native Caucus, and the AFN. The third approach that we're going to take in regards to sentencing is that we are devoting a significant portion of our next judicial conference to be held in June in Sitka to a sensitive, what they call a sensitivity session, where we're going to try to put across a cultural program, two and a half days involving Native sociology and Black sociology, in an effort to neutralize and to make certain that the courts are impartial in their sentencing approach to the individual involved. And the fourth measure that I can report to you is the Supreme Court is strongly supporting the suggestion of the Anchorage Native Caucus that a system-wide study be made of the criminal justice system. This will not go through funds from this legislature, but through the Governor's Commission on Criminal Justice, that a system-wide study be made to detect the pathology of racial bias and to suggest concrete remedies wherever it's found at any stage of the criminal justice system. Now, I would be less than candid with you if I ended here on the subject of racial bias. I think that it should be reiterated. Well, first, I think it's apparent that all judges in the Superior Court have been indicted and convicted of racial bias. And some of the judges weren't even sitting in the years in question, a significant number of them. But aside from that, you have to remember this, that the Judicial Council's study and our own check of the Judicial Council study did show that blacks get longer sentences and that natives do indeed have less chance of getting probation and are getting heavier misdemeanor sentences. But the Judicial Council's own study showed that it's a curious bias, that for homicide, kidnapping, rape, the judges are absolutely neutral. There are other categories where the judges are absolutely neutral, and there are some categories indeed where natives will get lesser sentences than their Caucasian counterparts. On the other hand, I want to assure you that all the information that went into the Judicial Council's study are matters of public record. The Public Defenders Agency knows this, the civil liberties groups know this, and they know that existing legal avenues are available to obtain judicial relief for those minority members who are serving sentences that are reflective of racial bias, if they can demonstrate that in fact they are serving sentences that are longer or because of racial bias. Well, I have full confidence that my colleagues in the Alaska court system have the integrity, the sincerity, and the commitment to ensure that all Alaskans, the public forums, do obtain the constitutional mandate of equal protections in the law, and we're going to strive for that. In conclusion, I think that it's appropriate to note that we've just celebrated our 20th year as a state. I think the Alaska court system has matured, along with the other separate branches of government, during these 20 years. And in this process, I think this is what is significant today. Although I've exposed to you some of our warts and our wins and admitted some of the defects and the need for remedial reform, I think what distinguishes Alaskan society and society in the United States from most social groups and governments on this planet is the fact that the ultimate aim of our government is justice to the citizens of within his particular entity. And it's towards that goal that I pledge to you that my colleague, myself, and all members on this court will continually strive, and that is to bring justice, as we know best, under the laws, equally to all Alaskans. I thank you for your attention.
Please come back to order.
That's why we never send them out.
Yeah. Happy to see you gentlemen return. We wondered how we were going to get out of here. Senator Coletta.
Mr. President, I move that the joint session
adjourned. Without objection, the joint session is adjourned. Well, thank you.
Will the House please stand at ease? We'll resume the session where we left off before the joint session. We're under special orders. Are there any further special orders to come before the House? Representative Cotton.
Speaker, I request the privilege of the floor to speak about an article in one of the newspapers.
Representative Cotton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm reading this article written by the AP reporter that deals with the House vote yesterday on the gas pipeline resolution that we passed. And there's a couple of points in the story that I'd like to comment on because I don't think they accurately reflect the facts. The second paragraph, and this is, I'm reading from the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. The second paragraph refers to the resolution saying that we conditionally committed to providing $1 billion in state-backed bonds. Well, the term I object to here is state-backed. I don't believe that the state has incurred any liability, and I think that one of the problems that that I'm having right now is talking with constituents and people who are anxious for the state not to invest money and not to commit money to the pipeline yet. And when a reporter refers to the bonds that we've authorized to be sold as state-backed, I think that the implication is that the state really is committed there. I don't think that's the case. Also, over in the third column, the reporter says that the tax-free bonds must be approved by Congress before they can be issued. And that's not quite so either. What has to happen before those bonds can be sold is that Congress has to approve an amendment to the IRS code that would allow those bonds to be sold tax-free. And before the bonds can be issued, this legislature has to approve them. And so I think, again, that it's misleading. And I thought that I'd bring that up and make that point. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Parr.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I have the privilege of the floor to speak on the Supreme Court?
Representative Parr.
Mr. Speaker, I'd just like to have my feelings known on this subject. From where I stand, I think that we've been very fortunate in the Supreme Court in the state of Alaska. I really think it's been a better Supreme Court than the U.S. Supreme Court, where I come from. And further, I feel that we're very, very fortunate to have Justice Rabinowitz as the Chief Justice.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I had a great long speech prepared on my last trip, but owing to the hour, I think I'll cut it down considerably. Passed out this morning was my report to you. I attempted to keep it away from just being a routine itinerary and look at some possible projections. My last paragraph really refers to how we as a state legislature or state government want to take what has been done. A lot of the stepping stones are in place, and if we want to expand on them and have trade, it's all there. We can do it. I was really quite impressed at what I saw in the Asian office. We've outgrown what we have, very definitely have outgrown it. It's expanded beyond anything that I had imagined. As far as tourism, we've neglected the market, and we're the ones at fault. We have only ourselves to blame for the tourist dollars that are not coming in. So this is a result of what I saw. For those who are interested in looking at such things as an itinerary, I have a stack of itineraries in my office. I didn't think it worth it to Xerox off 40 copies to have them go in the wastebasket, but for any of you who are interested, we will be happy to give you a copy. Just tell anyone in my office. I also transcribed the notes that I took in what I considered the most important meetings. Those are available to anyone who requests. And I also kept a journal. It amounted to 40 pages of chicken scratching. I don't think it holds much interest to anyone but me, but if anybody is interested in leafing through it, I will keep that available for a couple of days as well. I know that as far as my own experience, the taxpayers got their dollars worth out of me to the point that while we were in Korea, I didn't even exchange any money. I didn't get time, and the bank was right there in the hotel. So we weren't sightseeing as much as I had thought we would be before we left. We did sightsee when we get to China, but I think it's fair and important to interject here. We were guests of the Chinese government. They paid for our hotel, they paid for our food, and they paid for our transportation while in Peking. So that was not at state taxpayers' expense, only the airfare there and back. Any of you that would like to discuss details of the trip with the fields you're interested in, we discussed oil and gas, we discussed fisheries, tourism, agriculture, primary ones. We also received booklets in China of the different divisions or departments to contact for any area businessmen who are interested in looking at enterprises within China. I might add for those people who are interested, you're not going to control 51% of the company over there, China is. And so anyone entering into a negotiation with China, you're dealing with the government, you're not going to be setting up your own business corporation or dealing with one of their business corporations, they don't have them. Tremendously interesting and enlightening, and I certainly prefer our system of government where I can wear burgundy instead of navy blue, and where I can wear a dress instead of a pair of pants, and where I walk into the room and sit down, I'm fully accepted as an equal instead of have to be told, having other people have to be told that I sit on the finance committee and control the money. Thank you all for all you've given me, and thank you for the trip to help me see a little more clearly what you have given me, and I hope to return more of the trip to you as time goes on.
Are there any further special orders to come before the House? Announcements of committee meetings. Representative Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The House Permanent Fund Committee will meet today at 4:30 p.m. in the Bradley Room. The purpose of the meeting is to review the income and revenue projections of the Alaska Permanent Fund.
Representative Miller.
Speaker, House State Affairs will meet in room 115, there'll be a briefing on the state marine highway system.
Representative Meekins. Representative Parr.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Judiciary Committee will meet at 3 this afternoon. The bill shown on your calendars is not accurate because it did not get to us, so HB 316 will not be taken up. Instead, we will have House Bill 105, Recovery of Expenses on Disputed Tax Payments, House Bill 28, Presidential Party Primaries, and House Bill 6, Legislative Time Schedule for Organization and Operation. And all of these bills have been before the committee before.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. CRA will meet at 8:30 tomorrow in the Bradley Room and take up three bills. House Bill 184, Planning and Zoning Authority by Boroughs. House Bill 293, Right-of-Way Leasing. And House Bill 223, Disabled Veterans Exemption from Real Property Tax.
Representative Munson.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. The HES Committee will meet at 1 o'clock, and they'll take up House Bill 121, Special Appropriations for Kenai Community College, and House Bill 260, Participation of Legislators in State Retirement System. Also, I have an announcement for the Commerce Committee. They will meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock and also at 1:15 on the Alcohol Beverage Control Board in the Sunset. I have one more announcement, which is that the OGIG luncheon will be at the Baranoff Hotel today. Thank you.
Representative Hurlburt.
Mr. Speaker, the House Labor Management will be meeting at 7 o'clock tonight in the Bradley Room for markup session, House Bill 316, Preferential Hire.
Representative Osterbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Resource Committee will meet today at 2 o'clock for a local testimony on House Bill 193, Reorganization of the Board of Fish and Game, and at 3 o'clock we'll continue on the teleconference statewide.
Is there any further committee announcements? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Speaker, if there's no further business come before the House, I move and ask unanimous consent the House stand in adjournment till 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
There's nothing further to come before the House. We will stand adjournment till 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.